Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, Michael. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks very much, Caleb. Glad to be here.
First, I'd like to ask if you could just tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, I've been president of Wesleyan University since 2007. And I went to Wesleyan as a college student in the mid-70s, from 75 to 78. I grew up on Long Island, and my parents sent me off to college. They hadn't been to college themselves, but they thought the thing that they should be able to do for their kids was to give them the chance to go to college. And I've been in colleges more or less since since then. I started off wanting to be a writer, and at Wesleyan discovered that I also loved study, and my fields of study at the time were really the intersection of psychology, philosophy, and history. And Wesleyan was a kind of paradise for such things because you could make up your own major, you could take what you wanted. And I did that and graduated early, went off to get a PhD in history at Princeton. Wasn't sure I really wanted to do history, but I had a remarkable group of teachers there, as I did at Wesleyan, and they were very encouraging to do what you want. And I did a dissertation in the history of philosophy, philosophers who were followers of the Hegel, but they lived in France in the first part of the 20th century. And I was interested basically in the teachers of the people who became famous as deconstructionists or postmodernists. I studied the previous generation who were very deeply invested in history and not in deconstruction or anti-historical postmodernism. So I lived in France for a few years, and which was pretty wonderful. I had never really been out of the country before I got to go there, and had the good fortune to get a job in 82, 83 to start teaching at Scripps College in Claremont, California, which I did for about 12 years. And at some point while I was there, I was invited to the Getty Center to spend a year to work on a project that I had been developing on memory disorders and how they were conceptualized by doctors and philosophers. And I wound up liking the Getty so much that I prevailed upon them a year or so later to invite me back to run the program. And I did that for 5 years before becoming president of the California College of Arts and Crafts, and now the California College of Arts in San Francisco and Oakland. And after spending 7 years as president of CCA, Wesleyan contacted me quite shockingly from my perspective and asked if I'd be interested in being president of Wesleyan and they could talk with me. And I thought there was absolutely no danger that they would ask me to be president because I wasn't that kind of guy. And here I am 15 years later, still president of Wesleyan, and still writing books somewhere with history and philosophy and psychology and politics.
So in this newest book, it came out a few years ago, but the edition I have here comes with a new preface. And you know the subtitle of your book is A Pragmatist's Approach to Inclusion, Free Speech, and Political Correctness on College Campus. And in that preface, you talk about Richard Rorty in particular. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about why you titled it A Pragmatist Approach and the influence that certain pragmatist thinkers and philosophers had on your thinking on these issues.
Yeah, it's a great question. So I had the great good fortune of being a student of Dick Rorty's when I was at Princeton, and he was unhappily in the philosophy department, and I was unhappily in the history department, and he was just a fantastic teacher. He was just a remarkably gifted teacher, very, very funny, never smiled himself, but he was he made things clear, humorous, relevant, and he was a deflationary thinker. He kind of took things that were puffed up and he made them shrank them down. And I did my I did my dissertation on French Hegelianism, and he was on the committee. And to my great surprise, really shock, Dick, when asked him about the exam, he said, "There's only one person who could really read this dissertation with authority, and that's Victor Gurevich of Wesleyan, who was my philosophy teacher at Wesleyan." And I had some sense they knew each other, but I didn't realize they were actually very dear friends. And Victor Gurevich, who became a dear friend of mine, was a student of Leo Strauss. And so he and Rorty didn't see eye to eye on many things, but they were great friends. And to me, that modeled a kind of intellectual friendship. And, you know, what I take away from my study of the pragmatists with Rorty, and but also reading Emerson and Thoreau with Stanley Cavell, was a commitment to trying to find solutions to particular problems in particular places that would not be dependent on overarching principles, and but that would be still defensible in conversation or debate. My previous book, which was called Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters, also is a pragmatist approach to liberal learning. I have a lot of colleagues who say, "Oh, we love liberal arts education too, because it's all about the search for truth." And I have to say, I don't think truth enters into it at all. It's just really like the search for trying to do a little bit better, mucking along, and so they don't like that. The more conservative or even the radical liberal learning people, they do believe in truth with a capital T sometimes. And so believing in inquiry and conversation rather than truth and conclusions, I think that's something that Dick Rorty had a profound influence on me about.
Yeah, I was pleased to see in particular that you referenced Rorty's book, Contingency, Irony, Solidarity. I actually remember reading that as a junior at Wesleyan, and that being like one of the most like exciting moments that a person I think can have reading something like that.
Was that with Joe Rouse?
No, this was actually independent. This was independently, and then I was doing I don't know even how to describe it, honestly. I was doing like a tutorial on Don Quixote with Michael Armstrong Roche, and for each section of Don Quixote, we would read someone like Stanley Cavell or Judith Sklar or Cora Diamond, and try and then do a little, try and do a a kind of a writing assignment that was modeled off of their style or approach. And Richard Rorty, Michael Armstrong Roche was not as enthusiastic about Richard Rorty as I was, but I loved reading Contingency, Irony, Solidarity.
I just reviewed his posthumous collection of lectures. I reviewed for the Los Angeles Review of Books. He was a remarkably good writer and very funny. My class, we end this semester with postmodern bourgeois liberalism, which annoys everyone.
No, he really is one of the clearest writers. That's what I love so much about him, is that his just ability to take, I think your description of him as a deflationary writer is great, because he really does take things that get so puffed up, and he brings them down. down a notch, and not in a mean way, in a thoughtful way, a very thoughtful way. To stick on the book, as much as I would love to talk about Richard Rorty for the next 7 hours, you begin, I would say that this is sort of this book is a collection of three essays that all cover themes that are, you know, very hot button issues, very controversial today in academia. And your first discussion is about the legacy of affirmative action and this notion, these two different notions of affirmative action, or of how we might consider opening up the academy of between access and inclusion. So what is the access approach and what is the inclusion approach to education as you see it?
So in that first section, I'm interested in the way in which talk about affirmative action has been really replaced, as much as one can do it, with talk about inclusion. And so even a decade ago, I hired the first vice president of diversity, I think we called it at the time. And now that position has been defined as equity and inclusion. The diversity piece was about access, was about making sure that a highly selective school wasn't just filled with rich white kids and had certain criteria for enabling the opening of access to a broader populations and specifically populations that had been marginalized in the past. The problem for affirmative action defenders is it's just really hard to say why Jane got in and John didn't. I mean, it's probably because Jane may be from a better zip code, or you need more women, or there is really no good reason, because they're both capable of getting an A- at the university that. It's very hard to say why one gets in rather than the other. And so when debates about affirmative action get underway and a aggrieved person says, more people like me should be getting in. I mean, it's probably true. More people like you should be getting in, but there's just not room for everyone. So some people aren't going to get in. And so we're going to balance it out around certain identity markers. And it's just not very satisfying. As a general policy, because it violates sense of individual meritocracy, and you wind up using race as a proxy for other things, let's say previous lack of opportunity. And so much easier to say, whoever gets in should really feel included. Nobody disagrees with that. If we say, well, Caleb, you got in, but Roth didn't get in, are you really better than Roth? It's there's no winning that argument. But if I say, I want Caleb and Michael to both feel included, yeah, of course. So there's a shift over time to talking about making sure everybody has a great experience while they're on campus, however they got in. Because, people get in for all kinds of reasons. Some of them are defensible, and some of the times they're not defensible reasons. So one of the issues that arises here is that if you don't work on access, though, if you don't have something like affirmative action, In many places in the country, you will get a very racially homogeneous population. And that's bad for the education of everyone. The problem with inclusion is that it can degenerate into something like the customer is always right mentality. So that it's harder to feel included when somebody tells you you're wrong about something. I mean, I think the example I use in the book is if you're in an evolutionary biology class and you say, well, I believe that the book of Genesis holds the essential truth about the creation of the universe, that professor's probably going to tell you your view is not welcome in class. And however nicely they say it, or not nicely they say it, you get the message. And it's just harder to feel included in that way. And so what interested me in the chapter is really just showing this shift from debates about access to debates about how to make people feel more included. And, you know, I think schools are still wrestling with this, like schools that were historically white institutions that have become much more diverse. Sometimes they became diverse and said, you know, we like everybody to feel they too can play lacrosse. I don't know. Like most people don't want to play lacrosse. That's not the way they feel included. So they have to find other non-traditional ways of fostering inclusion, while at the same time maintaining something that's close to their historic identity. In other words, they want to have continuity with their history, but since their history was based on excluding certain groups, they don't want to have total continuity with their history. So that just leads to certain challenges about balancing critical thinking and inclusion, historical identity and inclusion. I use some examples in the book about high need students who see themselves like as an identity group. You know, let's say low-income students seeing themselves as an identity group, which is an interesting phenomenon because they probably don't want to remain low-income people for the rest of their lives. Or if they're first-generation students, their children won't be by definition. And that is different from, you know, the Christian Fellowship or the Malcolm X House or the or some of the other identity-based or religious practices-based groups. So I think that there's just a lot of pressure on how you can have community and inclusion while also fostering a sense of spirited debate, critical thinking, and social mobility.
Just to move into the second essay, where you talk about free speech and political correctness, I think you do a really interesting job of historicizing the political correctness debates. And I also think that, you know, the reason why I want to just move into talking about these, because I think that they'll also provide just a bit more color too for the first chapter, because these three essays really do intertwine with each other. So what is the kind of general history of the political correctness debates, and what do you see as the relationship between political correctness and free speech?
So I spent some time showing the highlights in the history of this phrase political correctness, which initially was used among leftists to criticize people who weren't towing the theoretical line, and then became kind of ironically used among leftists to say, you know, you Trotskyite aren't being politically correct, ha ha. And then into the late 60s and early 70s, when the new left said, you know, the problem with this old left is that it's too doctrinaire. And by doctrinaire, they meant the old left was trying too hard to be politically correct rather than exuberantly radical and revolutionary without doctrine. Moira Weigel has I guess, been working maybe on a book about this for some time and has written some about this history. And I mean, I thought an interesting case of Toni Cambabara and another feminist, maybe was it Audre Lorde, who get into a debate about, you know, who's doctrinaire, who's politically correct, who's a politically correct sister. And I thought that, you know, and there's a poem in which one talks to the other about, don't try to be correct, you know, try to be free. These kinds of debates. And these happened throughout the 1970s. But in the 1980s, there becomes another critique of college campuses that becomes the foundation for the contemporary use of political correctness and then woke culture. And that's Alan Bloom's Closing of the American Mind, which is in a kind of mid-80s book, you know, surprise bestseller, and becomes a template for many authors trying to make money selling politically charged books ever since. And what Bloom did was to accuse the university of fostering groupthink. He didn't talk about political correctness per se, but that we had groupthink. And what he meant by that was less about the idea, the explicit ideology that students and faculty had, but that they had a kind of nonchalant pluralism that led people to not take anything very seriously. Because you like cannibalism, I like fish. Okay. And so Bloom thought that the default position for academics of all kinds was that we can't really argue about the essential questions. If you like cannibalism and I like fish, that's just our value judgments and there's not much more to be said about it. And for Bloom, this was abdicating the role of the university, which was to explore the most challenging and difficult questions, the enduring questions. And by giving up on them, what you got instead were people who just wanted internships. I mean, the word internships would come later, but people who just wanted to get really good jobs and make a lot of money. Because the eternal questions, the enduring questions, the big value issues, you had your view, I had mine, let's have a beer. And so he bemoaned what the sins of relativism, really, which he thought was a symptom of the decay of modern Western culture. It was a kind of Nietzschean critique. He's influenced by Alexander Kojève, but it's a critique that we've got to a point in history where nobody cares about anything really essential. So it's what you care about is, I don't know, the size of your living room, the quality of your television, et cetera. But it was groupthink that really stuck for many people. Because Bloom's critique was also a critique of capitalism and market society. But what really stuck into the 90s was that groupthink was a problem. It was a problem for young people. And it was a problem for young people because professors were radical and they were indoctrinating young people into a mindset that was anti-Western, anti-patriarchal and anti-Western. So you can see this in the 90s, like somebody like Roger Kimball, who's in his first foray in this world. He didn't use the words politically correct very much, but then the second edition of the book, I don't know, it was like a dozen times or 15 times. And you see this all through the 90s. At Wesleyan, there's a group of students make a film called Politically Correct University, which is just, it's very jokey. It's, and it becomes a, you know, a meme, we would say today, about college and college professors and students. So I chart this development and how it leads eventually to what we today call woke culture. The problem, as it's conceptualized by conservatives and some moderate liberals, is that you can't say what you really think anymore because you would be accused of being politically incorrect. Or today we would say you'd be accused of being a racist. You know, that's the new substitution for this, that I can't say anything because somebody's going to say I'm a racist just because I say something awful about Black people or Asian people. Just because I said it, they'll say I'm a racist. and so everybody is against groupthink. Everybody is against this notion you can't say what you really think. It's so it seems. And so you have, I think I charted from the first Bush through Obama, every president gives a speech attacking political correctness. It just becomes a kind of effigy that you can, or scapegoat that you can use to talk about things you don't like about contemporary culture. And so under the guise of political correctness, people worry that nobody can say what they think and that free speech is being eroded. And we hear this a lot today, as you know, about college campuses.
I remember in like 2015, The Atlantic had a cover story. It was called The Coddling of the American Mind, which was later turned into a book by Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff. That title is clearly referencing the Bloom book.
One of many. You know, I reviewed that book in the Washington Post, and a section of it is in Safe Enough Spaces. I know, and I think that Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff, I mean, there are things that they say that are, I think, important. This idea about safetyism is you know, interesting. But I think that they, I really think that they're just saying, what's the matter with kids today? You know, basically, kids today don't realize that I'm a liberal too. I mean, I think a lot of it comes down to middle-aged people complaining that young people don't think they're cool anymore. I mean, I really do think that a lot of it comes, especially for people in academia who feel like students today don't care about what I care about. And so they're social justice warriors, or they're woke, or they're totalitarian, or it's groupthink, because they don't actually care anymore about what I care about. And when I talk about what I care about, they yell at me. Well, when people like, that's the people my age, you know, when we were young, we said the same thing about older people. I think older people then weren't so shocked to be treated like old people. Boomers like me, we're shocked to be considered old people. Like us, we're cool. We listen to the same music you guys do. That kind of nonsense, you know? And so I think that some of it is really just whining about the fact that students don't act the same way they did 40 years ago. And, you know, my view, and I say this in the book, is if you don't like students, you shouldn't be a teacher. I mean, that you can't, it's like if you're a card player, you don't complain about the hand you got. You know, if you're not a card player, you do. You just, oh my God, I can't believe, you just play the hand. And so if you can't figure out how to teach these young people, then it's probably time to let someone else become a teacher. Now, there, not to say that everything that happens on a campus is great, but I do think that the default position that people are intolerant or woke or politically correct is just is usually a sign that you're falling into a trope that is one that older people use about young people.
Yeah, I definitely, you know, think some of what you're saying is definitely a lot of the feelings that I've had about it, that there's this kind of this, a lot of it is this intergenerational conflict that we act like is new, but it's actually been around for quite some time. And that just the particular dynamics of it and other things, maybe social media make things even more, seem even more prevalent. Like, you know, now a teacher, like, for example, I'm on Twitter and I follow a lot of academics and a lot of students. And, you know, someone has a class where someone, teacher or someone says something that someone disagrees with, and then someone posts about it online. Something that was in a private classroom setting or context then becomes public. And that can lead to these blowups. Then it can lead to all of these issues around this. You know, a question I sort of have around this, and this isn't necessarily something that you particularly talk about, but it's definitely a tension point in your book, is whether or not universities are, you know, these conservative traditionalist institutions, or whether or not they're the vanguard of leftism. How is it that, you know, some people seem to see universities and they see them as like these ultra left institutions. And some people look at universities and see them as these ultra traditional conservative institutions.
Well, I think that universities have for a long time been a place for the anti-establishment actions or activities of young people. I mean, I think just that goes back a long way. When you see the earliest universities, they're always complaining about drunken students doing this and that. And where, you know, in the 1800s in Germany, which was the center of scientific research in universities, the dominant view of Americans went to study where it says that they got the students just got drunk and fought each other in these kind of silly duels, all dressed up as fraternity members. And what they're doing there is they're expressing an anti-establishment view that as they hold on to their independence before they join the market economy or the political society, you know, I think that's happened for a long time in colleges and universities. And in colleges and universities, there's often spirited debate about issues that you don't find spirited debate about away from campus because of the nature of inquiry and because people are trying out ideas without having to make, you know, eternal commitments to them. And so I think some of this has gone on for a very long time. I universities are also a place for sure where old books and now old movies and old paintings are considered with care in ways that they're not in popular culture. And that there's a kind of custodial function, especially in the humanities and to some of the social sciences, not in the sciences where they don't give a damn so much about, don't give a damn about history. They're always pushing ahead or trying to, you know, go on to the next discovery. And so they're anti-conservative in the sciences, although ideologically the scientists may be more conservative, but in their politics, they're trying to push ahead. So I think, you know, clearly in the United States, since the 1960s, and the tremendous growth in the number of students going to universities, and they're no longer just for wealthy people, and they're no longer just for white people. Since the 1960s, there's been a turn to the universities as a place for political experimentation, but also, you know, sexual experimentation, identity I think that's just happened because there are a lot of young people together who have not yet to forge commitments for which they'll have to take responsibility after graduation. And, you know, I think it's certainly true that the ideology of the faculty at most selective schools, especially on the coasts, is more similar to the left side of the American political spectrum than the rest of the political spectrum. I think that's, you know, then they vote Democratic and they have more liberal views about most subjects, as do most people who have more education, actually, though, and who aren't in the United States, who aren't on campuses. And so conservatives worry that, and they have worried since the early 1960s, even before the Vietnam protest, that the universities are being taken over by people who are not wedded to the establishment. And that part of that is just that the universities are not just bastions of old power. You know, they're now places for different kinds of people. So I think that the tendency of the university to experimentation, political and otherwise, makes people either put a lot of hope in them or get very nervous about them. The responsibility of the university to care for parts of culture that are not marketable, that's, I think, a different kind of responsibility. So there you can be a radical and be glad that the English department still teaches, I don't know, George Eliot or or Tom Paine or whomever, right? You don't only have to teach the latest and bestseller, or you don't always just have to teach television or something. But there are other conservative people say, but the canon at the university should always include, you know, these 10 books or something. And those people worry that the university is failing in its custodial function. But the university has both a custodial function, that is to care for things that aren't marketable, whether it's in art or literature or in unpopular histories. And it has an experimental function, which is to just try new stuff and not know where it's going to go. And I think those things can happily coexist, but they're different things. I think you can find an experimental reading of Shakespeare, to be sure, but one of the reasons you teach Milton or Shakespeare or I don't know, Aristotle, is just because it's part of a certain tradition that one doesn't want to see lost. And I think that is an important feature of the university, but it has to always be in relationship to the experimental feature of the university.
Yeah, I definitely, you know, in my time at Wesleyan, I definitely found that, you know, depending on what class you were in, they tended to, there were some classes, like my tutorial, my Don Quixote tutorial I was describing, obviously Don Quixote, you know, in considered to be in the great books canon, but the actual makeup of the class was very experimental. We were reading more contemporary writers. And then I also, you know, studied CSS. So I got my, you know, healthy share of Rousseau, Locke and Hobbes. I was wondering, you know, in your opinion, obviously keeping with these kind of, you know, the experimental function and the custodial function, and then also conservatives on campus versus liberals, how do you see the path forward in fostering the ability for these different types of thinkers to connect with each other?
Well, in the third section of Safe Enough Spaces, it's about free speech and intellectual diversity, and I think that that it's absolutely important for universities to cultivate a student body and a professoriate that brings a variety of perspectives onto whatever the topic at hand is. And I don't think that the free market approach to free speech, which has become, you know, very popular even among liberals in the US over the last, 40, 50 years, that's an adequate way to promote intellectual diversity. So I think free speech is a very important value. It's just like free market is an important thing. It's just not enough in either to protect people from, let's say, pollution, or to cultivate areas that need more investment, more cultivation. So I think the leaders of colleges and universities should challenge faculty to explore the biases they bring to hiring people, especially political biases and not just racial and ethnic biases. So, I mean, when I brought this up to the Wesleyan faculty, as I still do with limited success, and say, you know, you're just hiring people in anthropology, let's say, who just look like you, you know, who have the same kind of views you have, or in film, for example. And they say, well, no, we're just hiring the best people. And I have to point out to them, but that's what the old fart said to us when we said, you're only hiring white guys. You're not hiring women. You're not hiring people of color. And they say, oh, we'd love to, but we hire the best people. But the best people just happen to look like me. And the answer, you know, the kind of Rorty-esque response is, that's because the criteria you use are just the criteria that make you feel comfortable. You know, and think about that, don't you? You know, and then you give them examples. There's no hard, fast rule about these things. But I did hear, I remember from a guidance counselor who said that it would be malpractice if you didn't tell a student applying to Wesleyan, let's say, or Amherst or Yale, or wherever one of these schools, who said, I do a lot of civic engagement. I actually protest for the rights of the unborn. The advisor said it would be malpractice if I didn't tell them to leave that out. Now, if they said I defended abortion rights or, you know, right, freedom to choose, they would say, yeah, put it in. And I thought to myself, I actually found that surprised. I was embarrassed of how surprised I was to hear that. Because once they said, well, yeah, I, knowing the people over there in admissions, they're all good people, they'd say, no, but we really want moral people. And what they really mean is they want people with my morality. And so I've tried Wesleyan for the last decade, and it was a trustee and friend who kind of pointed out these biases to me, and I found them in my own classes. I found that, you know, trying to overcome them is an important thing. And as a president, I can actually I can give money to someone to hire people to help make that happen. And I think it makes the school stronger to not have everybody singing from the same choir book.
Why do you think it's so difficult to? Why do you think it's so difficult to get, you know, for example, or to try and convince someone to come to Wesleyan or to think that Wesleyan is like a good place who isn't necessarily in the mold of the political mold of what you said? Do you think that that's, you know, a matter of just self-selection, or is this something that has just occurred over time for some other reasons? Like you said, there's just a tendency for professors or, you know, academics on both coasts at elite institutions to have, you know, this kind of overarching, you know, liberal view. Is there a historical reason for this? Is there, you know, some other larger dynamics at play, you think?
Well, I think that there's the elite reproduces itself in some respects. I do think on the hiring side, it's because people hire folks that make them feel comfortable. And so we have no trouble finding good applicants for jobs in the humanities and interpretive social sciences who have different political views. I mean, I'm not saying we should hire Nazis. And that's what people say, oh, so you want us to hire Nazis or... No, that's why it's not a principle that we should, or quotas, that we should take seriously points of view about politics and that are different from our own. But on the student side, I actually do think a lot of people apply who have different views. They may just conceal those views for a while. You know, at Wesleyan, probably just maybe your freshman year, or maybe it could have been a year or so before, but, you know, a group of students came to see me because I had published this stuff about intellectual diversity and also about religion on campus, that so religious students feel discriminated against. So a group of students came to see me and said, would you be in a conversation with this evangelical who worked for Obama and organizing evangelicals? And I said, you know, you don't want me. I'm a secular person. I don't, you know. And they pushed. And finally, I said, okay, I'll do this. And I actually thought there would be 12 people in USDAN. It was, you know, and there were like 112 people show up for this little conversation. And what they kept telling me is, we don't actually talk about these issues because we know our professors don't want to. So the students are there. The Catholic students who practice, or the Jewish students who practice, or the libertarian students who are at Wesleyan. They just keep, you know, the people majoring in economics, which is probably the most popular major, or CSS, they're not like flaming radicals. They'll be at Morgan Stanley in 3 years, right?
You got that right. Not me.
You know, and so what I find unfortunate is that they conceal a good chunk of themselves because they know how to be successful in front of a faculty member. Whereas I would rather see, you know, the conversation in class where people feel like able to bring up a variety of points of view. And I don't, I mean, I understand the pressure of social media and being ostracized on social media. I mean, I recognize it's there. I don't know if that's, I don't know how important that is for people. I think, I see my job as to telling the faculty, look, this is a problem. And for them, because they're all actually really good professionals, they don't want to do this. I mean, if it's true, if they were convinced it was true, they would change. In other words, they are professionals. They're not just biased. Like they say, oh, if I have a bias, I should try to correct for it. And I think opening up the conversation to more political points of view, more perspectives on social change and issues of justice, I think that will just make the campus a more interesting and educative place. Listen, in the United States, there are few places other than a college campus where people are going to be living near other people who have such different socioeconomic backgrounds, come from different racial and ethnic groups, because you know America is so segregated that in a college campus you're just more likely to be physically closer to someone who's really different from you. Walking around Brooklyn there in Bushwick, sometimes it feels like the Wesleyan campus, right? A lot of young people with the same kind of clothes. And then there's the old Bushwick, right? The Latino Bushwick and other layers of the community. And at a college campus, you have those things kind of really compressed. And I think it's a waste if you don't try to find some way to tease out the different perspectives on a variety of issues.
No, yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Like it is as far as diversity is concerned, if you were to map just like density versus diversity of a place like Wesleyan, it's pretty remarkable. And I do remember in particular, I once had a class on, it was on modern economic history, and there was 10 people in the class and 9 different nationalities represented in the class. And of course it made for just unbelievably, fantastically interesting class. It was wonderful.
That is great. Yeah.
Just to now that we've discussed the book, I just wanted to know if you're working on anything new. Obviously, you're president of Wesleyan University, so you obviously have your hands filled with many things. But are you writing anything?
I am actually. So I'm going to be writing something about Stanley Cavell actually for the Los Angeles Review of Books, because there's a new collection of posthumous essays or occasional pieces that they brought together. So I continue to write about my teachers. but I just finished a book, a short book on the idea of the student, which is trying to understand what it meant to be a student of Socrates, what it meant to be a student in the medieval period, what it meant to be a student as universities just getting off the ground, and then the last 100 years, what is a college student? How has that idea of a college student evolved? So it's a painting with a spray can, I guess. I mean, it's starting off with Socrates, Confucius, and Jesus, and they're the people who follow them, three for each master, and then ending up with the contemporary university. So I just sent the manuscript off to the publisher, and we'll see what they think. They've been waiting for it. It was due during COVID, and I just finished it. I'm sure I'll have revisions to do I hope I'll have it back this summer to finish the revisions, and it will be out this time next year with any luck.
Well, thank you, Michael, for being on New Books Network. It was great talking to you.
Great to talk with you, and best of luck with everything.
Thank you.